There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? There are so many fabulous faraway places to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
And Rio just be only names to you and me. I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
Lynn Halton with us. She is a published author with an idea that has absolutely no boundaries to it. She's the creator of the lovehappyending.com. That's an interactive reader/author website to help promote a small group of new authors. And Lynn, hi, welcome to the show.
So much, Michael. Thank you very much for giving us this opportunity. It's the first time we've talked to anyone about lovehappyending.com.
Now, by the way, I think it is a phenomenal idea. Lynn, let's start from scratch. You're an author, and you had this idea. And you had an idea to it's really the definition of what social networking really is, combined into a small group. So let's talk about what gave you the idea and then the creation of the website. Where did you start at?
Well, it was my own experience, really. What happened was I gave up working full-time. I worked in finance and decided that I would start writing, something I'd always intended to do all my life. You know, you leave it to the end. And effectively what happened, I sat down, and this was 2.5 years ago, and wrote 5 manuscripts within 18 months. And I think an awful lot of people out there, an awful lot of people who want to write, do that sort of thing. The problem is they don't think beyond that point. And then obviously you've got to go through the submission process. Well, I was lucky enough to get a publisher who took on my first novel. That actually was published in February of this year. It wasn't until December of last year, so that's sort of like just 2 and a bit months before my first novel was due to come out, that someone actually mentioned the words author platform. I'd never heard it before, didn't know what it was about, had never taken part in social media. So I wasn't on Twitter, wasn't on Facebook, and I didn't have a personal website. It was actually a baptism by fire. I didn't even know enough to understand what exactly I didn't know. It was that sort of scenario, and I was uncomfortable. The first time in my life, I was used to being a professional in my finance career, but as a writer, I thought I could write a really good story, something someone would want to read, but I had no idea what I was doing about promoting and self-promoting.
Well, that's the best way to start. That is the best way to start. The best way to do anything is not knowing anything and jump right in, because you're not slanted in any way, shape, or form. What you learn is the reality and the heart of it right from the start. So I think it's a phenomenal idea. And the people that I would follow anywhere, any place, anytime, anyhow, are the people who just got in there and did it, as opposed to the people who researched.
I think you're very kind, though, because the problem is when you're new, and particularly social media, it's very hard to get started because you don't know the protocol. You do have to be sort of careful. And it very quickly became obvious to me that there were thousands of other new authors out there just like me, and we were all reinventing the same wheel, and we were all suffering frustrations, and we were all alone. And what amazed me was that, I mean, I'd never even thought of setting up a website, and I had to do everything within a 3-month period. So it was a steep learning curve. It was long days. But I suddenly found, as soon as I'd launched my website, that people were coming to me for advice. Other authors, other new authors, were looking at my website and assuming that I had some great wealth of knowledge or I'd been going for a long time. And they came to me for advice. I told them I was grateful to tell them whatever I'd learned, because I thought, well, I don't want other people going down all the dead ends I'd gone down. And in return, I picked their brains for shortcuts and tips to help me avoid the pitfalls, so that I didn't actually make a fool of myself before I'd even started. So it was hard.
No, but Lynn, this is the good stuff. I can imagine what it was like when you got up for breakfast the morning after you decided to do it, and you looked at your husband and said, guess what? We're international entrepreneurs. I thought I would tell you before we started the day.
I think I just give him a headache most of the time, to be honest with you, Michael. I'm a Gemini, and a typical Gemini, unfortunately, so I just never stop. So he's never surprised, and I think some of the time he doesn't actually listen. That helps. But I think the point I'm trying to make is that I'd gone through all that process, and I suddenly thought to myself, well, hang on a second. I'm doing all this for one book. Why not do it for 10 or 20 or 30? Why shouldn't we combine together a group of like-minded authors, share our precious knowledge that we've learned, support each other, and sort of try and raise our profiles collectively. And I think my initial sort of dream, and it's one of these things that just comes basically out of the blue in the middle of the night, for loveahappyending.com was twofold. Firstly, it was to give a group of new authors the chance to showcase their work and support each other, but on a website that actually supported them back. So it wasn't just a guest feature on this blog. It was, you stay on here, you will feature on our blog, your author web page will be there, and it will link back to your own website. But secondly, it was, well, why not make it interactive? Offer the readers the chance to work closely alongside their favorite new authors. So ask them to help getting the author's work and name out there by blogging, tweeting, and Facebooking. And a lot of readers are very experienced at that, more experienced than I actually was when I started. And in return, what we've done is given them the title of associate reader. And basically, they appear on their author pages, so they've got links to their blogs and their Twitter accounts. They actively support their authors wherever and whenever they can. And they get a chance to sit in the review chair, which is where we actually interview them and get a review off them for the author's books that they've actually read. So that was how it actually all started.
So they're almost like those others are almost like a focus group.
That's right, but also it's more personal than that. It's a more one-to-one. They may choose three or four authors, they may choose a dozen authors, they may choose one, but it is very much a one-to-one. So it is a partnership between the associate reader and the author. And I'll come on to that a bit in a minute, because if I just explain to you, this is my very first interview ever as well. So I am nervous because I am actually representing a whole group of wonderful authors who've joined together under the loveahappyending.com banner. And I need to make sure I say everything that needs to be said.
That's okay. I'm nervous too, so we're fine together.
No, you're not nervous. You're the consummate professional. I've heard you many times, and you've put people who feel very awkward at ease, and I must admit, I thought, well, if I'm going to start anywhere, I'm going to start with Michael.
Now, by the way, thank you for that. But when it really comes down to it, it's this. There are people out there, I remember when I think it was about 4 or 5 years ago, and I took a look at the amount of authors that were out there creating brand new books, and the figure was in the 100,000 to 200,000 range. And Lynn, this last year, you've got over 1 million brand new authors out there because of the change in the publishing, the self-publishing, and the e-books and the Kindle and so on and so forth. And I think what's happened, it's opened up a brand new world. It doesn't cost them tens of thousands of dollars and more to become an author today. Now, all of a sudden, you've got a lot of people out there with a lot of great ideas. The problem that they have is one that you're solving. The problem is that they have is exposure and what do I do once I get there? I'm all dressed up. Now what's the next step? And I think that's so critical because you've got some tremendous talent out there that will never be able to use that talent because they don't know where to take that step.
And it's also a question of people being new, like myself, not knowing protocols. And also, if people are going it alone and they don't have proof-checking skills themselves and they don't know better than to get it done for them if they can't proof-check adequately. I mean, I've read quite a few things lately, and the basic story's been good, but obviously it needed to be proof-checked by a professional, and it lets the author down. And it won't put off every reader, but it will put off some readers. So another thing that we are hoping to, I mean, and we're sort of running before we can walk here, because my sort of time scale for what we were going to roll out, it's just gone phenomenally quickly. It took 6 months to plan it. We only started setting up the website in May, not thinking we'd get the reaction we've actually got as quickly as we've got. We haven't even got all our authors on there yet. So we're sort of running before we walk. But the long-term aim was very much to actually also take on board people who haven't been published yet at all, self-published or via publishers. And where they need help like that, guidance is, well, hang on a second, this is very good, but it needs proof checking. You need a professional to sort of give you a bit of help and encouragement. We want to actually have a small core of people like that as well that we can bring on, and then they will become new authors, and we will have author pages for them.
And one area I think is absolutely brilliant is getting the reader involved, and there's a reason for that. In today's business world, with it, we're so crunched for time and money. You got to do so many things so quick, and you have less time to do it and less money for the most part. So people are out there scrambling for new clients, new customers, etc., and they're looking outside, and that's not the place to look. The place to look is inside. You build on what you have. And when you start to collaborate with the reader, who would be like a customer out there, all of a sudden they're vested in the venture. And now you've got a strength that most people don't have. I think the reader involvement is absolutely brilliant.
And I'll tell you, I mean, Michael, it just has astounded me. I mean, I don't know, for anyone who was tweeting a lot at the weekend, it turned out to be a bit of a love a happy ending tweet fest, and it was totally not coordinated. It's just that we've got half a dozen really good associate readers on board who are, I would say, semi-professional reviewers. Their websites are wonderful, their contacts are wonderful, they've linked with some of our authors. That, together with everyone else who seemed to be supporting us at the weekend, it got to the point where someone actually emailed me and said, enough, we've seen the brand, you're getting your name out there. I said, it's not me, honestly. And even, because obviously we are hoping to attract publishers for some of our authors, it won't be the correct route for all of them, but even a company called Third Coast Publishers were retweeting our tweets. And how fantastic was that? I was sat here watching everything going on, thinking, oh my goodness, I've set the monster rolling, and now they are taking it. And not only are they taking it, but they're running faster than even I thought they would run with it. So
Let me hold you up, because I think there's an important question to ask. In the group, how many authors is it limited to? Because if you have a million authors, it spreads it. You can never deal with the entire thing, and they don't get the full effect. So how many authors are we talking about that would be acceptable within the organization?
Right, we've got 16 at the moment, and we are going to go to a maximum of 30. And the plan is that, particularly with the sponsorship side, which I see is very important, is that if we can attract those funds, then it will launch some of these careers, because there are some really good books out there. I mean, it's just the fact that not every author, I mean, most authors, it's a publishing team of one. They do their own work, so they sell a book here, a book there. If we get sponsorship money and suddenly we're buying 8 copies of everybody's book on Monday and 8 copies of everybody's book on Tuesday, very soon the websites, the book websites, the internet websites that sell books will start to feature our authors. Now, if people then become successful, they will leave our website and always have contacts with us, but they will move on and they will vacate their space. Someone else will slot into it. So it will be revolving, and we would like that to be, we'd like the churn to be quite great, because it means we've achieved what we've wanted to achieve. But I see it very much as a partnership, and the we in this is the author, the reader, and the sponsor all benefiting, all in tandem, and all helping charity at the same time.
There is something you're dealing with the charity link. What exactly is that?
Right. If I just make it very clear, loveahappyending.com is not a business. It's will receive no money, no funds whatsoever. We see ourselves as just a portal, if you like, really. So what will happen is we are going to have a sister website, which we're going to set up, which will have dedicated sponsor pages on there, which will link to our website. But our blog on our main website, which at the moment isn't really up and running, at the moment it's just advertising for associate readers and basically our launch day on the 29th of June 2011, when we're going to have lots of free books and things like that and exciting things. But basically, the blog eventually is going to have lots of different features, and it's going to feature the sponsors. And what we're saying to sponsors are, basically, come to us. If you want to give a one-off donation or twice a year or yearly, that's fine. Tell us how much. We will spread that out between all our authors' books. We'll give you a list back of how many books to buy. So say every author would have 8 of their books purchased by the company who are giving the money. So their sort of finance department handle it. They get the receipt. They pay the money. They get the receipt. Those books, though, would not be sent to us. They would be sent to a charity, and we're talking to various charities now. The charities would then hold an auction, and whatever money came back from that auction, that charity would handle, and they would tell us off afterwards, obviously, how much was raised, because we'd want to put it on the website, we'd want the sponsors to know that, and we'd want our readers to know that. So if you like, really, in tough times, it's encouraging authors, and quite a few authors are actually taking time out to write simply because they've lost their jobs. At the end of the day, they've got to keep going somehow. But our longer-term plan is to offer more than that to sponsors. It's to offer an ongoing link via our sister website. And obviously, every time they donate, we will be sort of putting them on our blog and talking and telling our readers exactly how that is helping that author's career. But also, we've got longer-term plans. Some authors, particularly if someone's been made redundant, they may be an excellent writer, have excellent ideas, sure, but they can't afford to write. They have to earn a living. So there will be opportunities to sponsor a particular writer and their particular novel when it comes out. And that can go off in a whole different direction and get kudos for everyone involved, to be honest with you.
Now, by the way, I'm listening very closely to you, and one of the things that I think I would do, if I were you right now, and I was doing this, and I was projecting out in the future, because of the amount of writers there are, and if you limit it to 30, and you can't really do any more than that because you'll dilute the power of what you can give to each one. But what would happen if you got the 30 together? Everything was working fine. It was doing everything you wanted to do. In 6 months' time from now, you began a second one. You train somebody to do what you're doing, the CEO, and then you get a franchise. Then all of a sudden, you've got 50, 100 different groups of 30 different authors doing the same exact thing. Charities all over the place getting money. Authors who would never have been an author have the opportunity to do so.
That's an amazing extension, Michael. I must have been, I'm still struggling because my idea, what I thought was quite large anyway to start with, it's already grown beyond that. You've just extended it a further 1,000 miles.
Remember what I said at the beginning of the show. You jump in, who cares if you know what you're doing? You just go do it.
I think, to be honest with you, Michael, my attitude was this. I wanted to write all my life. I couldn't wait for the opportunity. It was a sad occurrence. It was the death of my mother, and I gave up my career to look after her, but she died within a 3-month period. So I suddenly found myself having the time in a sad scenario, but in actual fact it helped take my mind off of my loss and that sort of thing. And I think there are so many authors out there who writing is their love, and they still have to earn an income somehow, and I think it's very hard to get for a new author to get any exposure. Even if you've got a publisher, obviously the publisher can't give all the resource to you as an individual. So I think any help that any new author can get, we've got such a range just within our 30. I mean, our eldest is 88, and it's his life memoirs, which are amazing. Our youngest is a young woman who, in actual fact, I mean, I don't know if we've got time. Can I just read you a little bit from her blog, which really impressed me?
Yeah. Okay.
This is Lauren Howell, and basically she lives in Pennsylvania, and she's a young adult fantasy writer. And about 6 weeks ago, I think it was, she published on Kindle her first book, Rowan. And this is a little extract from a blog that I discovered a couple of days ago and got in touch with her, and she's on our website now. Today I am procrastinating, as I do every day, and today I just want to cry. Yep, cry. Curl up in bed and let the tears flow. Why, oh, why, oh, why did I ever put pen to paper and tell myself that someday I wanted people to read my words? It's been a month and 6 days since I published my first book, and honestly, it sucks. Sales suck. I know, it's a marathon, not a sprint, and it's only been a little over a month. These things take time, and lots of it. I suppose it wouldn't be so bad, though, if I didn't have people right and left asking me how book sales are going. People, family, no less, get bought it themselves. And this is what got me. In capital, she's written all, the time with an exclamation mark. And I thought that was brilliant. And then just a little bit, just one more sentence. She says, as far as I know, the only thing that will bring the book into the limelight are reviews. Reviews which most people don't like to leave. I'll admit, until I published my own book, I didn't leave reviews either. But now I see how important they are. But people need to buy and read the book before they read the reviews. And they aren't buying because they don't know it's there. It's an endless cycle I don't know how to break. And I contacted her immediately when I read that, and I said, had a look at her Kindle book. Very, very good. She's got lots of potential. That's the sort of person we're looking for. Thoroughly committed, energetic, enthusiastic, but really a little bit lost for, well, where do you go from here?
Let me take this a step further. And I want to take it back to a friend of mine from the way back, 30, 35 years ago, if not longer than that. And it was very interesting because religion has nothing to do with this, with the point I want to make, but this is what he had to go through. He was getting his doctorate in theology, and he went to France and Spain and Portugal and all of those Romance countries where they were predominantly Catholic in those countries. And he discovered something very interesting. In those countries, the psychiatric hospital, the beds were not as filled as they were in the rest of Europe. One of the reasons were they were predominantly Catholic. The one thing that Catholicism had or has is the ability to, it was confession. And what was going on when somebody would quote-unquote confess their sins, they felt better, less people in the psychiatric hospitals and on and on and on. And let me tell you what I'm hearing here and when I want to tie the story in with it. Most people who write may never have identity and acceptance and become somebody through another area, another modality. And when they write, it becomes them. A lot of the writing would become a legacy, like your mom was the stimulator for you to write. So in essence, that first book of yours is a legacy to your mother. Had it not been for her, the book probably wouldn't have been written in the way that it was written. So it's the
That's more true than you actually know, Michael. For another day, actually, because I'm very into, I've had a lot of psychic experiences in my life, and a lot of them around the time I was writing that book were to do with my mother making contact. But as I say, it's a story for another time. But you are so right. You've hit the nail on the head.
No, absolutely. No question about it. But I think the real key is their ability to express through pen. And I wonder how many writers that have the opportunity to do something that you're talking about that wouldn't have had it otherwise, it might have, Lena could save a life out there.
To be honest, I think particularly with the economic climate as it is at the moment, I think it's more likely people are going to be put off. And I think if there's any way we can say to people, well, look, okay, you know, we can't guarantee you any level of success, but all we can say is that if you're willing to put in the time and the effort, if you link with associate readers who want to champion you and do everything they can to help you, then you have a chance. You know, the world's your oyster. It's what you're going to make of it, really, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. No question about it. And I think for writers, for the most part, and I'm an author, and for writers, for the most part, there, whatever it is, if you look at the subject matter, fact, fun, fantasy, fiction, whatever the case may be, you'll find the writer within the context of the stories. And there's so many people, I'm going to bring it right back to this, that don't have the ability to express. They can't externalize what they're holding on inside. And symbolically, it comes out in the writing. And I think it's absolutely phenomenal. And I love what you're doing because obviously it's got to work because look what's happened so far and you haven't really even completed it yet.
I know. I mean, this was supposed to be, the run-up to launch was supposed to be quite quiet, allow us to test the website. You know, we're still tinkering with it, still not sort of totally happy. We didn't expect to get any interest, really, until we launched. And we've had to sort of bring everything forward and start sort of pushing information out there because we've just been overloaded with emails saying, how can I get on your website? How can I support your authors? And how wonderful. I mean, and what is amazing is that really some of these reviewers that are coming forward, they are semi-professional reviewers. They know what they're doing. They've got contacts and they've got energy. Their love of literature, their love of books of all genres. Although we do only focus on basically stories where it can be sad, it can be true life, it can tell you the horrors of, you know, how hard life can be. But it has to have a positive message. It has to be at the end, you know, there is a reason. People do survive terrible things, and they pick themselves up, and they go on to better things. So we always do want to sort of focus on the positive side whilst covering as many sort of genres as we can within that.
No, absolutely, no question about it. Now we're starting to run out of time. Lynn, do you have, the website where we can find you at?
Yes, it's HTTP, the normal thing, but it's just loveahappyending.com. Follow us on Facebook, and it's again loveahappyending.com. And on Twitter, we're at loveahappyend. So if you've been on Twitter recently, you will have, I'm sure, have seen some of our tirade of support. But it's just been wonderful and unbelievable. You know, I had what I thought was quite a lofty dream, quite an interesting dream, and it's already gone beyond that. And, you know, the sky's the limit, really.
Oh, no question about it. Hey, Lynn, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated every second of your time. I think you've got a heck of an idea. Go out there and get them.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you so much.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
Fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I've had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own. There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay?
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark, something like that, huh? Okay, Cat Wright coming up with this real quick.
And Rio just be under you and me. I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. So many simply incredible places to see.
Welcome back. Cat Wright with us. She's the author of Your Health in Your Hands, Living and Aging Well. She's the CEO of Frowny Skincare Company. She's a respected wellness educator and author, a nutritionalist, a naturopathic doctor with over 30 years of experience in helping people live longer, healthier lives. Again, the CEO of the Frowny Skincare Company. And she's the author of Your Health in Your Hands, Living and Aging Well, and creating Your Health in the Kitchen. That's the DVD. And let us say, Kat, I welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's great to be with you.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. You know, there's so many people who have quote-unquote skin problems. And I really believe if you take a look at someone, and I'm not a doctor, but if you take a look at someone and you look at the health of their skin, the expression, the glow or non-glow in their face and eyes, you can certainly tell a lot about them, can't you?
You absolutely can. And, you know, even the Chinese medicine uses visual diagnosis and the colors of the skin on the face, the tone, the texture of the skin. It's all important for determining how the healthy organs are inside. So the healthier you are inside your body, the more health will show on your skin. So it's a very interesting combination.
No, obviously, we've heard so long about the sun and skin cancer, etc. My brother is going to have a small operation. I think it's the end of this month. He's got a little bit of a melanoma, some skin cancer on his nose that they're going to fix. I mean, they said it's not a real problem and they can take care of it. But my contention really is that if he knew what he was doing ahead of time, you wouldn't have to have the melanoma in the first place.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more. And most people don't really think about that they can actually prevent those kind of cancers. They've heard so much about how aggressively damaging the sun is that they don't stop to think about the condition of the body. And it is exactly as you said. We have to respect the sun, but if we're taking in antioxidant-rich foods, we build our skin cells stronger and healthier, then we're able to tolerate the sun exposure. Again, you know, we've got to keep this conversation in perspective. We have to be respectful. If you burn your skin, it's definitely going to cause damage. But normal sun exposure shouldn't be so damaging as it is if the body's healthy and strong and intact.
Kit, 150 years ago when I was a kid, we used to run to the beach in Southern California, and we get burnt and brown and everything else. You know, I was one of those beach kids from the 50s. But the point, and nobody even knew anything about skin cancer. Obviously, it was going on at the time. It seems as though it wasn't as prevalent as it is today. The foods were different. They didn't have all the processing that most people get in their foods anyway today. But it seems as though the onset of it in the last maybe 20, 25 years has really come to the surface, and this is something that we truly have to take a look at, because it's better to spend a couple of bucks on something that is preventative as opposed to spending tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars in the hospital because you let it happen to you.
Well, you know, Here's the problem with avoiding the sun completely is that the sun on the surface of the skin produces vitamin D3 in the body. And vitamin D3 regulates over 3,000 immune functions. So if our immune system isn't functioning well, we're more susceptible to not only skin cancer, but every other disease, and especially diabetes, which we have another rampant epidemic in this country. So the more we lather on the SPFs and block the sun, the less vitamin D3 we have in our bodies, and the more susceptible we're going to be to not only skin cancer, but every other form of cancer. Vitamin D3 is a very inexpensive supplement that can be bought in any health food store, and it changes the perspective of a person's health. So we want a little bit of sun exposure, I believe, early in the daytime and later in the evening, so we're getting UV rays on the surface of the skin that actually help the body produce vitamin D3. But in addition, we probably should be taking it. And there's lots of research done on this. There's lots of information all over the internet. You just have to know to look for the information. It doesn't matter if it's there, you're not looking. And it's a really important thing for your listeners to know. Check out vitamin D3 conversation, and most people will want to start taking it. I entered myself into a study with vitamin D3 supplementation 3 years ago. Now, I got to tell you a little bit about me before you know this. I'm a volunteer swim coach and a swimmer. I love the water. I love the sunshine. I'm 56 years old. I was like you, out lathering myself up with baby oil and being out in the sun when I was much younger. But, I don't really avoid the sun. I'm in the sun a lot. But so I had my vitamin D3 levels tested, and I fell in the normal range but low. Normal but low. So I started taking vitamin D3, and I can only tell you what I took, but I took 5,000 to 10,000 international units a day. I live in a temperate climate in Ohio, and there's no sunshine here in the winter months, so I take more then, and then in the summer, I take the 5,000. I've been monitoring my vitamin D3 levels for 3 years every 6 months. I'm in the high normal range now, but I've never jumped outside of the normal range. It's pretty amazing that I could use so much vitamin D3, be in the sun so often, and most people that I work with that have their levels tested are well below normal ranges, and they're sick all the time. When they
Kat, let me jump in just for a second. Can you OD on D3?
You know, you can probably OD on anything. That's why I had my levels tested, and I started taking really what was is considered large amounts. Now, again, if you look at the research, it's all over the place. Some people think every adult should take a minimum of 4,000 units a day. Some tests prove that out. If we go from the standard recommended daily allowance of vitamin D3, which was determined in order to prevent rickets, they didn't even know all the functions of vitamin D3 when they set those limits. So now, and especially in other countries, the limits are being escalated. Here, we're a little more cautious to escalate the limits because we can look kind of foolish that we kept them so low for so long. So we kind of etch them up a little bit at a time. But really, they're saying easily 4,000 international units a day is safe for any adult. Children, they're more down at 1,000, 400 to 1,000. And, you know, when you start talking about increasing them to higher levels, you should, after you've been on vitamin D3 about 6 months, you should run into your doctor and get a test and see where you're at. You don't need to test it initially because everyone's low. It's just across the board.
Oh, by the way, I'm a total proponent of vitamin D3. Vitamin D3 is a hormone. I believe in it very strongly. When I start to feel off and I start to get sick, I'll load up on it and I'll take about 50,000 units. And
absolutely.
And for whatever reason, it's a very strong the backup for your immune system. And you mentioned the immune system before. Let's talk cancer for a moment. We're born with cancer cells in our body, and I think the big problem is because they're not foreign, we create them ourselves. The immune system doesn't recognize them, and by the time they proliferate, it's too late to do anything. And I really believe very strongly that you do the D3, you do everything that you can do to shore up that immune system, because the only thing that's going to cure you is the immune system. But the immune system needs to be fed.
You and I, Margo, are on the same page.
Yeah.
We agree. I agree totally. And, you know, I mean, I have in my book, Your Health in Your Hands, I've got recipes, I've got information to help people understand food and which ones are really a stress to the body. Some of the things that Americans eat stress the body. So the body isn't charged and refueled by their foods. It's actually stressed, and it's weakened by some foods that we consume. While other things, and to, you know, make it simple, drink water and eat more vegetables. And that gives you so much more benefit. If you could just every day continue to think about drinking clean water and adding another serving of vegetables and more clean water and another serving of vegetables, people would find that America would be much more healthy.
Oh, no question about it. And I really believe we're finding out more and more every day, and it comes up on the show usually at least once during the couple hours that we're on, is that the body is an electrochemical factory. The food you eat, there's nothing more. It turns into chemicals. The food is nothing more than chemical, and it goes to a certain place in the body. Wherever it goes to in the body, it's going to help that area function, or it's going to malfunction based on what goes in. And we're starting to, I say we as a country, as a world, are starting to get the idea that what we take in and what we eat is going to affect how we're going to be, if we're going to age well, if we're going to get old, if we're going to get sick, and it's so many different things. The ability to get up in the morning and smile and get through the day with a clear mind has got to do with what you put in your mouth.
Absolutely. You know, I raised 5 children on what I call a nutrient-dense, plant-based diet, just eating healthy, simple, healthy plants, foods that come out of the earth, no processed food unless I processed it in my kitchen, no fast food restaurants, and we spent less than $100 a year on medical expenses for over 20 years. They just did not get sick. Neither did we.
But, Kat, are you doing in this climate, when I say this climate today, you know, in your press release, this is shocking. One person dies of melanoma every hour. That's a lot of people. 2 million cases of non-melanoma skin cancer are diagnosed each year. 1 in 5 Americans will develop skin cancer during their lifetime. I mean, these are some phenomenal odds. Now, we live in a very fast-paced, microwavable world. Everybody's in a hurry to go someplace, and we've got to a point where people just don't do what you're talking about anymore. And what do you do? How do you get the average person to take a look at what they're doing, why they're doing it, and how they're doing it to save their lives or the lives of the kids?
You know, the average person that's thinking is planning for their education, they're planning for their marriage, they're planning for their children, they plan for your house, you plan your savings, but they don't plan to be healthy. No. Most average Americans expect that somewhere around 45, 50, 60 years old, they're going to start breaking down. They call that old. But at 56, and you sound like you're in your 50s also, at our age, if we plan to be healthy and we feel great, it's shocking that people give up and allow disease to take over their life and stop them in their 40s and 50s. I have friends with serious cancers that are 10 years younger than I am.
Sure.
They didn't plan to not have cancer.
By the way, when I how's this for a response? When I was your age, Radio Susie's over there laughing, going, "Yeah, right." When I was your age, I ended up with lung cancer, and I thought that I was doing everything I could possibly do before then. I mean, this is 13 years ago, so I was doing everything I could possibly do to live healthy. I've been a bodybuilder all my life. I do a healthy lifestyle, and all of a sudden, I'm hit with it. Now, I went the natural way. I didn't do chemotherapy. I didn't do radiation and the rest of it. And they actually took a lung out. But the key is, I really believe that what did it was what I stopped eating and what I started eating.
That's correct. That's correct. I've worked with so many people. As a matter of fact, 25 years ago, I met a lady. She was 52 years old, and she had some pretty serious health problems. And she changed her diet and her health. She stopped eating all the problem foods that you said, that Americans, most of what it is the American diet. And she started consuming better foods, and she started doing great. She ran her first marathon when she was 64 years old. And last summer, I was at an event with some other people that I had been coaching, and she happened to be at that event, and I had not seen her at probably close to 20 years. And I was like, in my head, I was doing these numbers, how old is she? And so I asked her. She's 74 years old. The people that were with me were appalled. She didn't look a day older than when I saw her last in her 50s.
Yeah.
It was amazing. She changed her profession. She ran a marathon, and she lives an abundant life.
Yeah.
No, because she changed her attitude and the foods she consumed.
Most people don't realize that your health, when you say you in the general sense of the word, your health is based on what you want it to be. You can control it. And the problem is most people won't take the time to control it. And that doesn't mean you have to get up in the morning and measure everything you eat and so on and so forth. But the real idea here is to be aware, just to have some mindfulness of what it is that you're doing to your body. Because life, if you live your life accidentally, you're going to get in trouble and you're going to end up getting sick. But try living your life, not you, but try living your life intentionally. There's a difference in the two.
You know, I say, I have a little ebook that I put out, and on it I have daily five little quotes to read that have to do with health, because I'm all about health and being proactive. And it starts with setting a goal for yourself, planning to be healthy, and having a reason to be healthy. So you have to think about where you're going if you want to get somewhere and how you're going to get there. And that's setting that plan and intending to get there. I set a plan when I was 30 years old to be 55, have clear, healthy skin, to be healthy and fit and be able to do whatever I was doing at 25 or 30 years old. And when I hit 55, I pulled out my written plan and I had arrived at where I wanted to be. But along the way, if I wasn't going to work out at the gym, or if I felt a little bit too tired, or if I was at an event and the food was really sloppy and I kind of wanted to give in to just eating anything and doing whatever, I remembered where I was going. And where I was going was what kept me moving in that direction and helped me make the proper choice at the right time.
Oh, by the way, and I think the operative word was there, the word choice is the key, because people have options and choices that they don't realize that we have options and choices about. And anybody sitting there listening to the show right now, you've got a choice, you've got an option. There are many, many things that you can do. If you don't feel good, there's a tremendous amount of things, a tremendous amount of natural things that you can do to feel better. I think one of the greatest things that you can do is smile. And because when you smile, it's like a dopamine rush. Your brain releases endorphins, and that makes you feel better. And all of a sudden, you're in a different mood. But it's the smile that triggers the chemical reaction. That old adage about laughter is the best medicine, that's why.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. You know, we have to understand that not choosing is a choice. Not choosing is a choice to go the direction that the majority of people go and to become one of the statistics.
Oh, by the way, I think that's another word that's an interesting word for everybody, the word statistics. Why become one? You know, we live in a world that the one thing, especially in this country, the one thing that nobody can take away from us is our ability to choose. And that's one of the things that we do have. We can talk about all the other kind of freedoms, but the freedom that we do have is we still have freedom of choice here. And you can choose anything you want to choose. You want to be sick? Yes. You want to feel good? Yes. It's all your choice. You just have to be responsible for the decision that you make.
That's correct. That's correct. And, you know, it's the you know, something that we really all have to admit is that we talk to ourselves all day long. We talk to ourselves with over 80,000 words. And statistically, they say that 90% of those 80,000 words you say to yourself every day are exactly the same. And if those words you say to yourself are negative words, then you're going to be program yourself to have a negative outcome. But if those words, you start intentionally programming the internal conversation. If I hear, I teach people that if you hear yourself saying, you know, why did I do that? That was so foolish, you know, and then we use worse words than foolish. Then I teach people to say, wait a minute, I'm not going to talk to myself that way. I wouldn't let anybody talk to me that way.
No, and by the way, let me hold you up for a minute because we've got just about 2 minutes to go, and I want to touch on Frownies, the skincare, because we're dealing with something whereby we're talking about saving somebody's life and not getting melanoma, and melanoma can be really dangerous because it's not just at the surface of the skin, it can move into the skin and through the body. So where do we find the skincare? I lost the word I wanted to use.
Frownies.com. It's like brownies with an F, F-R-O-W-N-I-E-S, frownies.com. You can sign up there for my free e-book, and you also can look around the website and find one of the things that topically using a whole-form vitamin E serum after you've been exposed to the sun will really calm down the skin and nourish the cells. Because of my naturopathic background and my commitment to health, I have formulated products, added products to a product that's been on the market for over 100 years, but I've formulated those liquid products to actually nourish and feed the skin. So it's helping topically fight antioxidant damage. And then nutritionally, you know, that's why I've written the books that I've written, Your Health in Your Hands, Your Health in the Kitchen, Living and Aging Well, Overcoming Diabetes, Disease, and Obesity. I just, you know, want to change the health of America. But you can find that all at frownies.com. And just start making intentional choices. The most important.
By the way, that's really where it's got to be. It's making the intentional choices. So we can there should be a myriad of products. You do have more than just that. We can find it all on the website.
Yes.
Good.
Yes, we can. I try to keep the line very simple and straightforward. It's about looking younger. That's what we want. But really, it's about looking our best, not young, but looking our best, not looking aged.
I buy that one 3,000%. Okay. By the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places. Mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there, so tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. So many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get...
I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You're listening to Dresser After Dark, and Dean Krant coming up real soon.
like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Dean Krant with us. He's the author of Presidential Powers, a comprehensive examination of the president's role as defined by the U.S. Constitution. He's a graduate from Princeton University, received his law degree from New York State School of Law, where he served as notes editor on the Law Review, and garnered several awards for his excellence in writing. He's clerked for the Honorable William T. Timbers of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, and then worked for the Department of Justice for the appellate staff of the Civil Division, and the list goes on, and this is really good information. Dean, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, presidential powers, it's getting a little confusing. And when I say confusing, what it was maybe 10, 15 years ago is not what it is today. And when we talk about presidential powers, we talk about who is going to define what they really are. So what do we do? We've got a constitution that says it's this, but we have a president that just walks by and does what he wants to do when he wants to do it.
Well, it's clear that there's been a trend towards enhanced presidential powers over the last 75 years, and President Obama is no exception. I think that there are continuities with President Bush's administration, but there are also some differences as well. I think that President Obama, like his predecessor, believes in an energetic executive, believes in taking responsibility, and believes in centralizing as much control as possible. But on the other hand, he's not as much of a unilateralist as his President Bush was, and believes in working with Congress domestically as well as other states abroad in fashioning policy.
Okay, but when that said, when he lets someone go, basically, when he's got to that point where he'll do a pardon or a commutation, what's the difference in what he's done as opposed to what the other presidents have done? When we let somebody go, what kind of a person do we let go?
Well, in terms of the pardon power, he has certainly left that power relatively untapped. Indeed, it's very interesting because in some ways he's not as very much similar to his record so far is very similar to that of President Bush. Both of them, with rare exceptions, did not use it because they disagreed with a policy decision by Congress in terms of criminalizing particular action, didn't use it because they thought that particular punishment was too harsh, didn't use it because they thought that some instances people were unfairly punished. Rather, they've used it sporadically to restore the civil rights of individuals who committed nonviolent offenses over 25, 30 years ago. Most recently, he used it to help someone who was smuggling alligator hides and someone who didn't report fully to the Customs Authority, some marijuana offenses and so forth.
Okay, but when we look at this and the president's role, and again, is defined by the U.S. Constitution, and when we look at the Constitution today, how close do we adhere to it? It's Harold Grant. I'm sorry, I had said Dean. It's Harold. Harold, how closely do we look at that? How close do we adhere to the Constitution today? I think we're getting into a scary area here.
Well, not in terms of the pardon power. I disagree with you on that one because the pardon power has always been viewed as a sort of trapping or a sign of executive authority, and that's been true in many countries around the world. The Constitution doesn't limit the power of the pardons except for cases of impeachment, and of course it must be related to commissions of federal law offenses as opposed to state law offenses. And presidents from George Washington on have used the pardon power for, in fact, far more dynamically than President Obama has. Where I think you can suggest that President Obama has been more adventurous than predecessors in the 19th century is certainly with his view that all authority conferred upon the executive branch to all the agencies, for instance, really is his authority, that he can manage that authority massage that authority as he wishes, whether it has to do with health care or Guantanamo Bay.
Okay, Harold, though, what we have, which I think is very interesting, we have presidential power, and then we have presidential power in an emergency. All of a sudden, it's a completely different power, and they exercise a different area that normally, quote-unquote, stays asleep. That transition of power, what does the president become in an emergency?
Well, that's something that we still haven't charted and defined over the years. There is no provision in the Constitution to grant the president extraordinary powers in time of emergency. So when emergencies have confronted presidents, as they have from time immemorial, presidents must decide, do they act unilaterally and hope that Congress follows? Do they act unilaterally and don't even inform Congress? Or do they wait for Congress to authorize their actions? President Lincoln famously said, as you no doubt recall, that the first priority of a country is to save it, and you must defend it first and then worry about constitutional liberties second. And he took a number of steps, including ordering a blockade in terms of suspending habeas corpus, that many find would be blatantly unconstitutional. He did go back afterwards and ask Congress for ratification, just as President Jefferson had when he made the Louisiana Purchase. But they believe that in the emergency, it's up to them to define it and to chart out the course in order to preserve the Union as the most important obligation of the presidency. The problem is the interpretation is hard to know where to stop. Many people criticize President Bush II because he believed that an emergency was ongoing because of the terrorism threat, and that justified eavesdropping on individuals in this country, intercepting emails, and tapping phones, all to confront this emergency. So the problem with that is, of course, that there's no end. Fortunately for us and for President Obama, he hasn't faced that type of emergency, though financially we were pretty close in terms of a difficult situation. So we don't know exactly how President Obama would act in that kind of emergency, but we certainly know he is not averse to decisive action in terms of hunting down Osama bin Laden and sure. other terrorists.
Now, by the way, the presidential powers, the average person sitting at home having breakfast, and for the most part, that average person doesn't understand the dynamic of politics, the difference in both sides of the aisle and the conflicts that they come into and how the decision-making process is made. But when it really comes down to it, it's with the president and his signature, isn't it?
I think it actually comes down to a question of politics more than law. And I think that the president realizes what kind of popularity he's cresting, and understands the whip, some kind of actions, how they may play out in either the court of international opinion or domestic opinion. So when it really comes down to it, I think that the actual limitations in the Constitution may mean less than political realities and constraints. I don't think that means that we should ignore the Constitution. I think it means that I agree with you that it's dangerous if to the extent that we veer more away from the Constitution. But nonetheless, I think most presidents are very self-conscious that they are political actors and they need to take the political steps that they need to be either vigorous in the public eye or to defend the Union.
Sure, and I think one of the biggest confusions we had when with quote-unquote President Bush declaring war. It was backed by Congress, and the president in and of themselves can't just say, forget everybody else, I'm going to go do this. And for the most part, we have that, we either don't know or we forget very easily based on our political bent. The president is tremendously powerful, but so is the Congress, so is the House, so is every representative out there collectively together. And the president has powers, there's presidential powers, but I think it's driven by the decisions made by those constituents and those, not so much the constituents, but those elected officials that are behind the president, whoever that might be at the time.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And I think at the time of the founding, there's no debate that the Constitution was written in part to limit congressional power. The experience in the Continental Congress, the experience in the legislatures in the various colonies was such that legislatures were dominant. They were managing fighting, they were judging in particular legal disputes, They were really taking all power into their hands. So the Constitution was framed with an eye on reducing legislative power because Congress was the most feared branch. That, of course, has changed dramatically, very dramatically. It's changed in part because of the threats that face the nation financially as well as foreign powers. But it's also, and I think you suggested this, it's changed because as Congress has gotten bigger and bigger and grown, it's had more difficulty in terms of acting coherently, acting in a collectively effective fashion. And frankly, Congress has given away most of its powers. Congress can reassert it, and at times has reasserted its powers, but for the most part is content to be led by a resurgent and very powerful executive.
Yeah, no question about that. And I really believe what it's come to is we still have a semblance of the Constitution. We've got to have that basic something to go by. One of the things the Founding Fathers were concerned about also, they realized that the electorate at the time wasn't too bright. They really didn't have the wherewithal to be able to vote for those particular people that they could run the country. And on top of that, most everybody was their ranchers or farmers, and where's the vote going to come from? So, i.e., the Electoral College. So the Founding Fathers, smart as they were, had to look at it from both ends, not let, quote-unquote, the elected officials rule, and also that the constituency may not be smart enough to be able to make the decisions of who to elect into office. And so it was a very interesting role that they had and a very interesting balance that they had to keep coming up with. I think they walked a very razor-edged fence for a while.
One of the fascinating things about the Constitution is that in some ways it arose out of pessimism, which you were alluding to. Pessimism about the nature of the electorate, pessimism about the nature of our leaders. Because the writers believed that we were always influenced by passions. Passions of the day could be tariffs, it could be religion, it could be being anti-British or anti-French, and that those passions are not good for the public weal. So they tried to devise ways to slow down laws, to make things more conservative, to make sure that change came more slowly, because they believed that we were protected more as individuals in the long run in terms of our freedoms if we had a government that moved much more deliberately, much more slowly, and that our liberties were preserved ultimately.
No, by the way, I think one of the things that we're looking at also is that this defensive posture that both sides have, which is very hard to make any kind of a decision. And that what we really have is our fear through all of these mixed messages. They cause apathy with the constituents, and there's where I think a lot of the confusion is that we have today. So the president has power, the Congress has power, and it seems as though that the average person is getting less and less power even through the pen and the vote than we've had before. And everything seems to be going in a nationalistic sort of way, which puts a different position for everybody, the different kind of power that everybody will assert. A congressman today may not be what a congressman was 30, 40 years ago, et cetera, et cetera. So we're looking at a very interesting world that we're walking into, that the country that we know, if we're not very careful, Harold, may not be the country that we'll have in the next 20 years.
There's been very rapid change over the last 75 years in terms of the structure of government, the rise of the agencies, which some people call the fourth branch of government, but really are extension of the executive branch. So who knows what will happen in another 25 or 30 years? There may be another sea change. One of the things to think about why this happened is that the founders never anticipated the rise of political parties. And so much of the stalemate that you've talked about, so much of the inertia can be attributed to the difficulties of partisanship that arose out of political parties. And even though it may seem naive that we didn't expect that at the time, the founders didn't, and they were deeply disappointed when, within 5 years, the parties began to take shape, and that really altered the dynamic between Congress and president a great deal, and still we have stalemate and filibusters and so forth.
No, I think one of the biggest problems that we have today, whether it be presidential power or understanding the Congress, the House, et cetera, is rhetorically, how do you navigate a very complex system? And our system has become so complex, we need people like yourself to put the pen a way to understand what it is that we're dealing with and what we face. If I don't know what it is, I can't do anything about it. But if I do know what it is, if I have some kind of an idea, an indicator of what I'm dealing with, then all of a sudden it's a whole different world out here.
You know, it's an interesting analogy that you've drawn to the whole financial disaster. Many people think that our financial system is so complex, and the instruments, the futures instruments, the hedges, the swaps, the calls, have become so complex that even sophisticated analysts don't really understand the products that they're peddling. And I think you're right that we don't understand the workings of government that well from the outside. It's very difficult for individuals to judge what's going on, and most of the power is still exercised behind closed doors, usually in an agency, sometimes in the White House, in ways that are not easily fathomed by the public.
Yeah, and I think that this word, the T word, transparency, is a word that they talk about, but that's about the extent of it. The public at large, for the most part, has no idea. They're not. When I say the public isn't sophisticated, we have a very smart public, but not necessarily to politics, not necessarily to the dynamic of how a decision is made. And that's not something that everybody's going to know. And again, I'm going to use the word apathy. It creates apathy. It gets us to a point where, here's a tried and true statement that I don't know if my vote counts anymore. And that, I think, is one of the biggest problems that we have today. And it's called, how do you go back and simplify the entire thing? We need to learn something, whatever it be, is a step-by-step-by-step process to have an understanding. And I don't know necessarily that the public at large will ever get a handle on what goes on politically anymore, because it has become extremely complex.
I disagree with the Tea Party activists in many substantive ways, but on the other hand, I admire the activism. I admire the fact that they want to understand the government and that they're trying to simplify government in an effort that they can become more involved. And I think that's very healthy for the country.
Oh, by the way, absolutely, and I'm a very strong proponent of a Tea Party-like organization without all of the clouds and the accusations that go along with it. Just average Americans standing up and say, I'm tired of this. It's confusing to me. I want my country back the way my country was and the way it was presented to me and the way I grew up with it. And I think more and more today, quote unquote, the sleeping giant is starting to wake up, and we're taking a look at what's going on. It's been quiet for too long. We'll go back to the financial condition, going back to the lenders. You know, you buy a house, you pay X amount of dollars for it, and you got a certain amount of interest over a period certain. And that loan that you have from the bank, they package the loan up. Now you got 10, 15 loans, and they sell it off to somebody. And that package becomes packaged, and then they sell it off. And now that thing is worth billions of dollars because people are investing in it. And if it all crashes, which it did, those billions of dollars worth of properties are maybe $10, $15 million worth. There's where the problems lie. Confusion, confusion, confusion. And nobody stepped up to the plate to say, stop it, because it's not right. There's where I think a problem is. People are afraid to open their mouth in particular situations and positions.
We all have to be prepared. We never know when it's going to happen, and it's obviously easier to follow the crowd. And that's really why, going back to the presidency question, that's what you want. You want the president to be able to not accept advice from advisors and from leading people in the press. You want them to be able to take adventuresome stands, and that's what a leadership is about. And we try to preserve that through the Constitution. We try to preserve that through politics. But even some presidents have not lived up to the ideal that you sketched out.
No, I hear you loud and clear. Now, by the way, we're running out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at and a place to buy the book?
Well, you can find the book on Amazon's website, and you can find out more about me at Chicago Kent College of Law, which is where I am professor and dean. And we'll continue on, because the questions of presidential powers, as you say, will adapt and change over the next coming years.
And by the way, Harold Grant, thank you so much for joining us.
Take care.
Take care. Good night.
And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a loving burning light will warm the winter night. Well, that's all. Well, that's all.
There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Alexandra DiRusio-Cooper is with us. She's the author of So What? It's a Teen's Guide to What Really Matters, and that's so critically important today. She's a youth coach, a speaker, an author, founder of Your Life, Our Work blogs, a lead for the youth coaching. That's the Academy USA and featured speaker blogger for teen I'm going to say trepreneur. That's a good word for me. Alexandra, help me with that word. Is it trepreneur? Oh, I wonder if she's there.
Hello?
Oh, there you are. Okay.
There I am.
Okay. I got stuck on a word, Alexandra. Is it a teen trepreneur?
Teen-trepreneur, yes.
Oh, good. Okay, now I got the word down. Okay. Having been a teen.
It's like entrepreneur, but for teens.
I got it. I tripped on the word, and I thought, there is a word I haven't heard before. By the way, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, when we talk about teens, teenagers, they're a whole different, what do I want to say? They're a whole different, they're a whole different world out there with teens today than teens before, 10, 15, 20, 20 years ago. And I imagine that there is a language to speak to them today that we haven't had before. You got a lot of kids out there that are texting. They're so high tech, and they think differently than people did 15 or 20 years ago. How do you touch them? How do you reach them?
Absolutely. And I think not only is it a different language, it's a different understanding. And that's kind of why I feel like I'm in a good position right now to be writing this book and have this book available. I think you connect with them using a way of finding commonality. I think even I text, and I'm guessing maybe you do as well, Michael, and just talking to them on their level and not really talking down to them. And I think it's a huge thing nowadays in teaching and parenting and being a youth coach is just speaking to them as a peer and as an equal rather than speaking down to them. Kind of as if you're a friend on the other end of a text message and just saying, what's up, you know, what's going on and how can I help you?
I think one of the biggest problems that we have with kids today, especially with parents, parents are not friends. Parents are parents. And I think there's a big difference that, you know, I wouldn't want to talk down to a teen. That's not even in my head. But there are so many things that the teens don't know yet. There are so many life experiences out there that they're not even aware that they could run into. Alexandra, they could go out and get themselves in a lot of trouble accidentally by just not knowing how to go out and maneuver through life in and of itself. You know, you've got to be able to navigate, but to navigate, you have to understand what's really out there and how to deal with it. And then there's that word called consequence. We have so many kids today in general, they're brought up without consequence. I can take you back 40, 50 years or so, and more than that, actually. And there was a time when you didn't open your mouth to mom and dad. Mom and dad ran the house. It was their house. And you listened to what they said. And you were, quote unquote, more afraid of them than you were of going out and getting in trouble. So you kept it pretty good. So that's why I think it's a challenge today, not an unbeatable challenge, but it's a challenge today to deal with the kids that we have and the culture that they're in.
Exactly. I completely agree with you that, you know, parents are still parents, and it's not all about being their friend. But like I talk about in my book, I do have a section on family, and it's just all about creating a positive and kind of open, judgment-free environment at home that really needs to be a safe place, because teens nowadays are going through so much heck at school, at work, wherever they're at. You know, there's a lot of judgment, a lot of expectations, a lot of peer pressure and bullying, and I think at home needs to be an open place so that they can ask questions and they can get the information they need, because, no, at the age of teenage, when we're 16, we don't know everything, even if we think we do. So you need to be able to have a place to go and say, you know, I'm thinking of going to a party, what do you think, so that parents can kind of teach them the lessons they need, you know, telling them to look out for drugs and alcohol and the consequences of it. But I think a lot of times some households don't have that open environment, so kids are afraid to ask, or kids are afraid to admit to their mistakes and get that positive feedback. So I think it's really, really key that parents and teens have a really positive relationship, because that open environment is so, so essential in growing and learning and, you know, like you said, knowing consequences without always having to experience them.
Oh, sure. And I think what's extremely important is that that it's like alcoholism. People go to AA and they go through and they get recovered. But if they're going to go through and there's going to be an academic that's working with them, a doctor, somebody that's gotten their information out of books and study, that's not going to work. What helps those people are those people who have been there, have done that, and gone through the challenges and know. That's why I think that somebody writing a book about teens has got to be real close to it, and can't be more than a quote unquote more than a few years older than being a teen, and that way you can have somebody relate to you. It's not like you don't know, you know. You've been there, you've done that.
Yeah, you know, and again, that's why I felt like it was such a right time for me to write this book for teens, is because I was like all of them. I mean, I got some great opportunities that I'm so grateful for. At the age of 16, you know, I got into the personal development world and going to those seminars and listening to those tapes, but I was still experiencing getting teased or bullied. So much pressure from academics, looking forward to college years and having fights with my parents at home or my little sister. You know, I was just like every single person out there, and I found ways and strategies and tools to kind of work through it and step life up to the next level and get through those hard times. So in my book, I made sure to add so much heart into it. I put all of myself into it and shared those personal stories, even if they were embarrassing or tough times. You know, I think it's important that we use what we learn from to help other people, to teach other people, and kind of share with them what we went through, because it lets them know and gives them permission to admit that they're going through hard times as well. And that's the first sign and or the first step in really wanting to make change in your life.
Young woman, probably early 20s, with a little kid of about, oh, a year or so old, and my mind is thinking, you're going to get yours back now. Payback's tough. But it's learning what it's like to be a parent and having to go through all of that. And I really believe that books like yours, when you get a hold of the kids and have them realize that there's responsibility, there's that they have to deal with, is that it stops a lot of problems, because they'll teach their children what they've learned. And if you haven't learned it, you cannot teach it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I agree with that completely.
Yeah, but when I was saying with the young women, with the kids, because in about 15, 16, 17 years from this point, it's payback time, because they're going to get, they gave out. That's what I was talking about. Small joke. But anyhow, the book in and of itself, I pick the book up. I'm a teenager now. I pick it up. I read it page by page, cover to cover. What's my takeaway? What do I, Michael Ray, get out of that book that I didn't have before I read it?
I think the understanding that you actually have control of your life. I know we all kind of feel at the age of 16, 17, whatever it is, that we don't have control, that we're kind of dictated by school and by work and by our relationships with our friends and our family and all of that. But what I'm confident is that this book kind of teaches people that they need to take care of themselves and they need to take care of the people around them and the direction their life is taking, and they can make some decisions to make that happen. You know, I have a section on goal setting, which I feel so strongly about, because it's not about just wishing and wanting things. It's about making an action plan and dreaming big and making things happen. And I think far too often we forget about that, and we lose sight of things and kind of just go along with what people tell us to do. So my book will kind of give teenagers the tools to say, hey, I really want to do well in school, and I'm going to make it happen. I'm not going to play the victim because of my circumstances. I'm going to make some good results out of this. So I think the biggest thing is that they'll realize they're normal. They're just like anybody else, and they can make anything happen. And it's in their hands.
No, and it got it loud and clear. And I think one of the most important things that you'd be dealing with is that when you're dealing with the teenagers in and of themselves, the word, and you've got it in your section one, the you, the self-image, that's one of the most important things that's so critical, because if you don't have a decent self-image, you're going to go through life very confused, and you're going to try to create an image that belongs to someone else. And you're never going to be that image. You can never be someone else's perfect. You've got to be who you are. And I think self-image is the thing that's going to be the stimulator, that instigator, to go out and have a decent life or go out and get yourself in trouble.
Absolutely. You know, and like you said, self-image is kind of created by our surroundings. And I share a story in there about when I was young, about 6, 7 years old, and I had buck teeth with a big old gap in between them, but when I was that young, I didn't really care about it. I used to, whenever Jell-O was in my lunch at school, I would squirt the Jell-O out between my teeth, and all the kids would laugh, and I thought it was this cool thing that I had this gap in between my teeth. And then I started growing up and realizing that kids were teasing me about it, and all of a sudden my self-image had changed. So it's this huge thing that kids, unfortunately, can be kind of mean, and there's a lot of judgments flying around. So like you said, you know, the self-image is kind of the fuel that drives your car. If you don't have that strong self-image and confidence, it's going to be really hard to achieve some big goals that you have for yourself. So I really, really do like that first section. That's why I kind of started the book with that, so that they can continue on the journey of the book with that strong confidence.
One other thing also in that section is bullying. Years ago, when you had a bully, they ran after you and they beat you up and it was the end of it and nobody worried about it later on. But today, you've got cyber bullies. You've got bullies who are dangerous. You've got bullies who will tease somebody into taking their life and then still make fun of them at the graveyard. You know, so it's something that has gone completely out of control, and that's something that has to be faced, and kids have to know how to deal with bullies.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, with the internet nowadays, text messaging, whatever it is, it kind of crosses these lines where it gets rid of that safe space of being at home, of being away from school. And I think it's so important just to, one, raise awareness about it. And in my book, I kind of talk about ways to manage it and handle it. And sometimes it gets to the point where you have to avoid the situation. But before that, it's about stepping up and giving that bully, it sounds strange, but the respect of having a conversation with them. People think, that's crazy, a bully won't listen to me if I tell them to stop. But the fact of the matter is, if you tell them to stop, people will start seeing that it's not a cool thing anymore. And you never know how people will be influenced by the people around them. You have to get people on your side and just to realize, you know, it's not cool to bully people. So I have always continued to encourage people, students, whoever it is, to stand up for the little guy and to say, there's no reason to be treating somebody like this, and, you know, we got to all band together and just make sure people realize that's not a good trend to be passing along. You know, and it's hard because we have to go to schools and talk to teachers about it, and sometimes it's not taken seriously. So it just gets to a point where you have to choose the situations you put yourself in, and you have to stand up for yourself, which can be a really scary thing. But it is a bad, bad trend going on in schools nowadays. We continually hear about it, seeing videos of it on YouTube and stuff like that. So it's something I think we really need to focus on in our society.
And the other thing, too, is let's touch on sexuality for a minute. There's so many youngsters having babies, and it's not the problem of having a baby, but when you're 14, 15 years old, your life has got to stop when this happens, because it takes a more mature mind to be able to deal with a baby. It's like giving up the rest of your youth, and a lot of these kids just don't realize it anymore, and it's hard to talk to them because you've got all of this mixed messages in the media and the Lady Gagas and the rest of it that people, it creates a light that it's okay, and it's not okay, not because of morality, because of the life that they're going to miss by ending up with a baby at 15, 16 years old.
Oh, I completely agree. And, I mean, that touches on a great point about how the media has such an impact and influence on our lives. And it's just unfortunate that there's not too many positive female role models out there. And there's nothing taking away from Lady Gaga. I mean, she's a great musician. But she sends out certain messages, and a lot of her fan base are younger teenage girls. And like you said, it does take away from that kind of innocent teenage childlike years when you end up becoming a mother at 16. And I think the important thing there goes back to what we talked about with families, having that open communication at home so that the daughter can go to her mom and say, you know, I'm dating a boy, or we were approached with the topic of sex and I don't know what to do. Because ultimately that's what it comes down to, is they didn't realize the consequences, because I really doubt that many 14, 15-year-olds decide to have a child at that age. And It's just about teaching awareness about how to prevent it, the consequences of having sex at that age, and things along those lines, because sometimes our peers aren't our best influences. You know, friends and girls who might like the guy you're with might tell you it's an okay thing to do or that it's cool or popular and a mature decision, but we get some mixed messages, like you said, with the media, and it's just very hard to filter that out since it's such a big part of our lives. And I think, again, it's very important to have those conversations at home so that it's kind of a strong foundation for what they go forward in with school.
Also, the other thing that happens is this, which I think is good. If they will approach their mom or dad, whoever it is, that the respect that they would give the parent to say, I want to talk to you about this, and what that does underneath, well, Alexandra, it creates a bond that they may not have had before.
Exactly, exactly. And something I like to think is to tell teenagers that I work with is that you get exactly what you give when it comes to your relationship with your parents. You know, the more honesty you give your parents, the more trust you gain. The more trust you gain from your parents, the more freedoms they give you. So if it becomes a situation where they have to nag you to get you to be honest about what's going on, then you're going to have to nag them for that trust and that freedom. So when you have this open, honest communication with your parents, they're likely to return that same respect and trust with you.
No question about it. So realistically, what I can see, that the core message of the book is the ability to, quote unquote, bond with family, bond with those people that are close to you, be able to express all of those things that you've held inside and locked up. And I think that's one of the most important things. I think if kids today have the ability to talk to somebody in the family and open up and to say anything that they want to say and go into that neutral space where they're not going to get judged or yelled at, et cetera, I think things would be completely different. Because a parent today, they're hamstrung. Their hands are tied behind their back. If the kid steps out of line and you stand up to the kid, then you've got child enforcement, you got problems from people in school, you got the police department. So, my goodness, I don't know how much control a parent even has anymore today, whereby that gives the child the ability to do anything that they want to do, and there's no consequence.
Yeah, I think it's a really, really fine line that parents and teens are having to walk nowadays as far as creating that healthy relationship that fits into all of the expectations. But it's just, yeah, I'm glad I talked about it in my book because it's so important, you know, to have that space at home that's kind of that judgment-free zone, that comfortable, open space so that you can express yourself and get that advice, because I think without that advice, a lot of teenagers end up being lost. And, you know, I was very blessed to have a great, great growing up with my parents, and, you know, it's time for me to pay it forward by sharing with other people how they can create those relationships with their kids. And that's with my book, is it's geared towards teens, but I'm really looking forward to the fact that parents and teachers are reading it, because it helps them create those relationships with the young people that they interact with. So it's really, really great in that sense that it's not just for teenagers, but also the adults who are looking to get something out of it.
No question about it. Alexandra, we're starting to run out of time. Website that we can find you at?
AlexandraDiRuscio.com, and my last name is DiRuscio, and you can find all the information on the book there and all of my speaking and coaching as well.
Wonderful. Okay, and we can buy the books, and if somebody wants to bring you into a speaking engagement, all that information is right there at the website.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Dynamite. Hey, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me on this evening, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
Bye-bye.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all, oh, that's all. We'll be right back.
All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore. Yeah, it's me that you'll adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Mark Emery Bowles with us. He's the author, co-author of Job. It's a guide to job hunting online. It's What Color Is Your Parachute? It's the sixth edition. It's blogging, career sites, gateways, getting interviews, job boards, job searching engines, personal websites, posting resumes, research sites, social networking, transferable skills, and so much more. And this has gone way beyond just walking into a place and saying, I want a job. So Mark Emery Bowles, he's worked as a computer programmer, technical writer, a musician, a musical instrument maker. He's an expert on using the internet to support the job hunter, particularly with alternative career paths. And let us say, Mark, I welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. You know, in today's world, What Color Is Your Parachute? Guide to Job Hunting Online. There was a time when somebody would apply for a job and maybe you had five or six or seven people that you went up against in competition. That's not so today, especially with the marketplace that the way it is and the economy the way it is. You may have 10,000 people up there looking for the same job. So I think we lost them. All right, so let's see if we can get him back. So, okay, good. All right. That we have you back with Mark, with people looking, so many people. Okay. All right. So take a look at what you got if you're going to look for a job. You, I went through the list in the beginning with the first page of the book. You can blog, career sites, there's gateways, getting interviews, there's job boards. There's so many things that you can use the internet for today to take a look. Also, resumes. You know, resumes are very important because resumes are going to make you or break you. And one of the things that that you have to do before you're sitting in front of that person who's going to hire you or not hire you, the one thing that you have to do is you have to be able to know what you're doing and what you want out of that interview. Because if you don't know what you want, neither will that person behind the desk want. And from what I've found over the years, interestingly enough, it's a two-sided interview. Not only are they interviewing you, but you've got to interview them. Is it the job that you truly, really want? And most people are concerned about getting a job. They're going to do anything to get a job. They're going to make a few bucks. Things start to straighten out. And guess what? You don't like the job anymore. So it's taking a look at what it is that you want. You can research it. And if you do it the right way and you're in the right place at the right time and learn how to use all the instruments and tools that were not available years ago, then all of a sudden you can find the job that you're looking for. You can do the things that you want to do. And you find out where to go. Well, you know, you post a resume. Years ago when you posted a resume, maybe, I don't know, 50, 60, 100 people will see it. You post it in the right place at the right time. You may end up with, a couple of thousand people, if not more, looking at that resume. Let's see what we, oh, good. I'm Mark. We just job hunted all over the place. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know what happened. My telephone just died there, so I called back on my other line.
Oh, no, it worked great, but thank goodness for the front and the back of your book. I was rolling like I knew what I was talking about.
Okay, I'd like to get as much information out as possible.
Yeah. Now let me ask you this, and realistically, when somebody is job hunting today, the rules have changed. And there's no question about it. One of the things that I was talking about was years ago when you applied for a job, you looked for a place, you posted on a board, a couple of hundred people may see it. Now, if you do it right, you can get exposed to literally, you know, tens of thousands of places that might hire you. Now, let's go back personally with you. What was it that caught your eye, caused you to take a look at this and really research it and then put it to pen?
Well, plainly, the internet in a very short period of time has changed our society in a lot of ways, and job hunting not the least of these. The way that people go about the job hunt has changed so radically, particularly in the last 5 years, I think, is when we've really seen a great turnaround in the approach people have to take to job hunting. Without the internet, you're pretty much invisible to a lot of companies, and the companies are often invisible to you. The internet is such a great research tool that most job hunters just can't afford to ignore it.
No, by the way, you've got these, this, as you call them, the super sites. You got Monster, Career Builder, and effectively, they're ineffective, if I can say it that way. Where is the best place to go? Where does a person zero in on to find that job that they're looking for?
Well, there's a lot of ways to do it. In a general sense, you can take a passive or an active approach. If you put your resume up on an internet site and wait for somebody to contact you, you're pretty much taking a passive approach. There's lots of places you can do that. There's about 40,000 job boards on the internet at present time. But it's not always the best way to do it. If you want to find the job that will give you the most satisfaction, the salary, all the things that we're looking for, you usually need to take a more active approach and use the internet as more of a research tool than merely a post your resume and sit by the phone and wait a kind of tool.
Sure. Now, by the way, when you take a look at this, you know, and there's so many people out there looking for jobs today with that 9% plus unemployment, and it goes higher than that based on where you are, time and place. There's most people who just don't know how to look for a job today, and I think that's really the operative way to take a look at this. You know, what you've got is that guide, and I've got it in front of me. It's that way to, excuse me, hold somebody's hand and take them through. Most people have no idea what to do today. That's why I think books like this are absolutely critical. But how do you get it into most people's hands? How do you get it to a point whereby they realize that what they're looking for is there?
Well, that's a real problem. Most people, when they think of internet job hunting, they think that all they have to do is go to one of the super sites like Monster or Career Builder, and pretty soon they'll have a job. They really don't know how ineffective those sites actually are. And the latest figures, nobody knows exactly, but they're approximately effective for 4% of the people that use them. So that means that out of 100 people, 96 never find a job through these sites. So what it usually takes is certain degree of frustration and being out of work for a long time before they start reaching out for what other forms of help there are, like my book.
Now, by the way, one of the things that you talk about, and I think it's absolutely, it's just a smart way to think that most people won't think. Rather than going to the business networking sites, to hobby forums, go to places where you would normally not think of going to look for a job.
Yeah, one of the things about going to the standard social media sites like LinkedIn, which is a very powerful business networking site, but its real problem is the only thing you have in common with the other people you meet there is a certain amount of ambition. Usually, relationships need a little bit more. I say in the book that the glue that binds relationships together is common experience. And if all the common experience you have with someone else is a certain amount of ambition and wanting to get ahead in your job, that's not as strong as some actual interest that you might have in common with other people. And that tends to build stronger relationships, and those people are more likely to help you.
Now, by the way, there are pitfalls. I mean, people know about social networking, obviously. The sites are there, et cetera. But there's the fatal flaw that you talk about that all of them have, and there is a way to get around it. What's that flaw? What is it that we should look for that we didn't know was there?
Well, the flaw of all the networking sites is that they're all completely separate. Every one of these networks is a completely separate network, unattached to each other, and in fact, in competition with each other, and they don't really have any real impetus to try and change that. So at this point, there's not that much you can do other than picking your sites carefully and not going willy-nilly all over the place. For instance, Facebook is, as we all know, the most popular site on the internet by far.
Sure.
But it really doesn't have that much for job hunters at this point. There are some websites where you can go where some businesses are starting to put job postings on Facebook, and there are sites that glean those, and you can go to those sites and pick the jobs out. But they, at this point, they're not really that helpful. There are the same sort of things for Twitter. There's a site called Tweet My Jobs, and a number of other competitors like that that are a little more effective. But really, when it comes to social media, LinkedIn is the best one to go to because the people there tend to be more business-oriented. It's a more mature site, and the people there know what they're doing. It's really well-run and doesn't have some of the privacy issues that Facebook has, for example.
You know, by the way, critically, for so many people that they're up against much competition today, It's called know where to go. And not only know where to go, but know how to use it when you get there. Job hunting online absolutely is become really the main, I think that's the main road for most people today. We are so high tech anymore that we think of the computer, the BlackBerry, et cetera, and it can follow you anywhere you go. But it's called where do you go, and you've been talking about where to go. It's called where do you go? And more important than that is what do you do when you get there? But that first step was to find the place. And there's got to be a second step to it. You job hunt online, you find the right place, the right whatever, but you've got to have whatever it takes to move to that second step. But without the first step, none of it matters, does it?
No, that's very true.
Now, by the way, what got the two of you involved in this? What was it that turned the light bulb on and said, I've got to research this, I've got to put this to pen?
Well, my father wrote a book, it's been almost 40 years ago, called What Color Is Your Parachute? And it's the most popular job hunting book of all time. It's sold, I think, something close to 12 million copies now. And so it's become a kind of family business. In that we talk about it a lot, and as the internet started to become more popular, I was well involved in the internet. I've been involved in computers since the middle 70s, and so this was a way of kind of bringing together what my father does and what I do. He originally wrote a small little pamphlet about the internet. I think it was back in the middle 90s, and it's grown into the present book that I've written, this edition.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah, but I was going to say, look at the difference in the internet today than the middle 90s. My goodness, it's expanded to such a point. I guess your dad would have had a field day if it would have been the way it is now.
Yeah, absolutely. No, as I said earlier, it's in the last 5 years, there's been an explosion on the internet of websites that are intended to help the job hunter. But there's also a lot of websites that are intended to, I don't know a better way to put it, but in many ways the job hunter can be victimized if he's not careful on the internet. A lot of people want your money. They'll be happy to write your resume and do a number of other services that in the end are not always that helpful for the job hunter.
And by the way, interesting point, because I hadn't even thought about that. You can walk into a disaster, can't you? If you're not sure what to look out for.
Absolutely true. In fact, there was a bit of a scandal recently. A well-known job site has been severely criticized for running scams on job hunters, particularly when it comes to resumes.
Yeah.
So you really have to do your research and be careful where you go and what you do.
Now, let me ask you this. The book in and of itself, can we find it on your website?
Yes.
Now, Mark, what is the website?
Oh, I'm sorry. The website is www.job-huntingonline.webs.com.
Okay, now let me ask you this, because I think this is a critically important topic, and it's something that so many people need to get into today. Is there something? Is there a question that I should have asked you that I didn't, that would have brought more information up for we, the listening audience, that we could have got? I want to make sure we cover our bases on this. In today's world especially, this is so critically important.
Well, I think the main thing that people should know is that the internet is really just a way of reaching other people. It's not just computers that we're all connecting to. There are people behind these computers. And in the final analysis, when you're job hunting, you're really looking for other people. And you have to remember that instead of thinking that you're looking for other computers that are going to get you to your goal. In that sense, the internet will only take you so far. And at some point, you've got to get away from the computer and actually talk to the people that you've connected to using the internet.
That's going to be a problem for a lot of people if they can't go beyond their text. But that's another book and another story. Mark, let me ask
you. True
enough. Okay, one more time, please, with your website. We're running out of time now, and I want to make sure that everybody gets this.
Okay, it is www.job-hunting-online.webs.com.
Okay, and by the way, Mark, if anybody missed it, it's going to be up on our website, so it's going to be up there for a long time. If anybody misses the website, it'll be up on ours. And Mark, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Off comes the makeup. Off comes the clown's disguise. The curtain's fallen. The music softly dies. But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door. As they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment. And as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you. But now the curtain falls.